Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is a great honour for me to be able to welcome Larry Summers, President of Harvard, to the school today. One of the last speeches I made as chairman of the Financial Services Authority was, in fact, at a Harvard conference, which Larry opened, a conference on international accounting standards. So I can absolutely guarantee that his speech today will be more interesting than mine was then. Larry has been president of Harvard since the summer of 2001. For him, of course, unlike for me coming here, it was very much a case of going home. He did his doctorate there in the 70s. He taught briefly at MIT before going back to Harvard, where he was more or less through the 1980s, when he went to Washington, where he began in the World Bank, and then, of course, moved into the Treasury under the Clinton administration when he was Undersecretary for International Affairs, which was when we first met, and then was promoted to Deputy Secretary by Robert Rubin, and then to be Secretary in 1999. And in all of these positions, his influence on the global economy, on the shape and activities of the international financial institutions was immense, and indeed his influence on financial regulation, as I can personally attest. So we're delighted that he is here today. The links between the LSE and Harvard over the years have been many and various. I discovered that he had been here on a sabbatical from Harvard at one point, working in the economics department, indeed working with Mervyn King and Charlie Bean and others, and indeed, which I didn't know, that his father was here, which is something which he has in common with the current Treasury Secretary, John Snow, whose father was also at the LSE. Whether or not that is the only thing he has in common with the current Treasury Secretary, we shall see. But this lecture today strengthens the relationship between our two institutions further, and I should say another idea I just floated with Larry over coffee was that maybe it would be a good idea to merge the financial endowments of Harvard and the LSE and manage them for the benefit of both institutions. And he, Larry's thinking about that, and I think he will be thinking about it for the whole of his tenure. He is going to speak to us on Europe and America in the 21st century. Now, if this is a purely and rigorously historical analysis, then this should be short and we'll be away by about three. But I suspect that it must be more forward-looking. But when I make speeches, one thing I find most irritating is when the person introducing you, who may have read the text, begins to summarize everything that you're going to say, which I won't do. Larry.
Thank you very much, Howard, for that very kind introduction. One nice thing about being an economist and coming to the London School of Economics is that you usually get introduced without an economist joke. It wasn't so long ago that I was introduced by the guy who said, "Larry, do you know what it takes to succeed as an economist?" And I said, "No." And he said, "An economist is someone who's pretty good with figures but doesn't quite have the personality to be an accountant." That was in Moscow. And nobody in the audience got the joke, which says something very profound about the work the LSE has to do, Howard. Howard, I hope that the transition from government service to academia is proving as enjoyable for you as it has been for me. One thing I can tell you from my own transition is that you have not left behind the art of politics. Think about that for a moment. I did, as Howard mentioned, spend many happy and enlightening years here at the LSC. First as a child when my father was on sabbatical, and then when I was on sabbatical in 1987, I did come here with a dark suspicion that I was not going to be allowed to enter until I presented the prepared text, for the completed text from the Robbins lectures that I had delivered 12 years ago and am still on default with respect to. So I am grateful that that opportunity has been missed. I must say that the LSC has, in addition to the elements that you struck, and perhaps we'll leave our finances to be a non-common element a little longer, Howard, does share with Harvard a commitment to the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake. But the LSC is blessed, as I hope Harvard is, with a faculty that is very much concerned with the relevance of its research to the problems of the day. And it is one of those challenges that I want to talk about today. An issue that I believe is of profound importance to the United States, to Britain, to Europe, and indeed the world. The evolution of the transatlantic relationship in the 21st century. As co-chair, along with Henry Kissinger, of a Council of Foreign Relations task force on this subject, I've been involved for some months now in thinking about the relationship's past and its future. And it's on that subject that I want to speak this afternoon. I should be very clear at the outset in saying that anything that I say that is perceptive was almost certainly first someone else's idea, but that I am speaking here only for myself, and the views I express should not be attributed to the U.S. government, to Harvard University, to Henry Kissinger, to the Council on Foreign Relations, or to any of the members of its task force. And my objective is not to make immediate policy prescriptions for what should be done tomorrow or next week, but to try to understand the current situation and raise for discussion some thoughts as we go forward. I shall reflect on three issues. First, I want to assess the current state of the relationship and to argue that for a variety of reasons, we are in difficult and uncharted territory without the possibility of return to the entirely familiar territory and congenial territory of the past. Second, I will try to make the case that continued fracturing of the Atlantic Alliance, or even a failure to close the cleavages of the last 2 years, would have grave consequences for the United States, for Europe, and for the world as a whole. And third, I will offer some suggestions as to the best way forward on both sides of the Atlantic. Begin by taking the long view. The accomplishments of the transatlantic alliance in the period since the Second World War have far exceeded what even optimists could have hoped for in the late 1940s. Indeed, history records few, if any, alliances that have yielded such benefits to their members or the broader international community. Lord Ismay's famous dictum that NATO's purpose was to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down captures well the main dimensions of the alliance's success. After centuries of recurrent conflict, war between the powers of Western Europe has become inconceivable. The Cold War has been won. The side of freedom has prevailed. The 20th century's threat of global nuclear conflict has receded, and the totalitarian ideologies that supported the slaughter of over 100 million people by their own governments no longer pose a global threat. Driven by technology but permitted by politics, the global system of trade, travel, and investment is far more open than at any point in human history. And the result of growing integration has been more progress in raising the living standards of humanity in rich and poor countries alike than in any half century in the history of the world. It does not disparage the accomplishments of statesmen in any country to suggest that none of these achievements would have been possible without the Atlantic Alliance and its manifestations, NATO, American troops in Europe, the Marshall Plan, the UN, and other international institutions. All of this supported by the habit of close consultation on all matters of profound importance. To be sure, in admiring past accomplishments and worrying over current tensions, it's easy to forget the transatlantic confrontation over Suez, the degree of anti-Americanism in Europe engendered during the Vietnam period, the strains on the alliance in the early Reagan years. Remembering these episodes, some are prepared to be relatively complacent about current tensions, arguing that in many ways the Iraq War, whatever its merits, is sui generis, and that with patience, this crisis, too, shall pass. I confess that I am not so sure. In the last year, France and Germany did not just fail to support, but actively organized opposition, in enlisting Russia and China and nations around the world in opposing what the United States had announced as a major U.S. national security initiative. Some political leaders in Europe sought to and succeeded in increasing their popularity by attacking the legitimacy of the United States. At the same time, some American officials appeared to be many to be disregarding Europe, and when they paid attention to Europe, to be seeking to split the Union. And prominent Americans and Europeans began to wonder out loud about the death of the West. On both sides of the Atlantic, we need to think about the Eurobarometer survey that came out last week. That survey found that a majority of Europeans see the United States as a threat to world peace. Indeed, the fraction of Europeans seeing the United States as a threat to world peace slightly exceeded the fraction seeing Iran and North Korea as a threat to world peace, and was significantly exceeded only by the fraction alarmed by Israel. The fraction seeing the United States as a threat to world peace far exceeded the fraction seeing China or Pakistan or Syria as a threat to world peace. It has seemed at some moments over the last year that the United States is the object of malign intent in at least some European quarters, and that Europe, in some American quarters, is at least the object of malign neglect. The idea of the United States as a hyperpower that must be contained or at least constrained has become increasingly fashionable in Europe, whereas the notion of coalitions of the willing without great concern for who joins up has become fashionable in the United States. Why and why now? There is, to be sure, much that can be questioned in the conduct of diplomacy on both sides of the Atlantic over the last year. Communications channels were not kept open. Negotiation on key points at times took place through the press. statements were made more for domestic consumption than to promote international comity. Disagreements were not managed but allowed to escalate into confrontations. There was very little of what is necessary, and alliances to have meaning, adjustment of national policies in response to the needs of allies. This all is very different than the norm in the Atlantic Alliance. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Premier Khrushchev placed missiles in the Western Hemisphere, very close to American soil, President Clinton sent senior statesman Dean Acheson to consult with allies regarding the American policy response, including the possibility of preemptive actions directed at the Soviet missiles in Cuba. President de Gaulle famously turned away Acheson's offer to present the photographic evidence, saying that he trusted the word of the President of the United States and that France would support the United States in whatever course it took. As many misunderstandings as there have been on both sides over the last 18 months, though, it would be a mistake to see the tensions besetting the alliance as dominantly matters of diplomacy or personality. Rather, much of the strain arises from the response over time on both sides of the Atlantic to the events of two dates, 11-9, the date when the Berlin Wall fell, and 9-11, when terrorists destroyed the World Trade Center and killed 3,000 Americans. Take first, 11-9-1989. With the collapse of the Soviet Empire and the existential need for solidarity that drove agreements and ensured the careful management of disagreements, that glue has been removed. The unification of Germany and the comfortable integration of a unified Germany into the European Union are historic achievements. But with the Soviets durably out and the Germans durably integrated, the felt need on both sides of the Atlantic for the Americans to be in was inevitably attenuated. In important respects, the Atlantic Alliance risks becoming a victim of its own success. There is another important aspect of 11-9 and all that followed. Existential threats concentrate national attention. And with their removal, domestic political considerations inevitably loom larger in the decision-making of national governments. Without the Soviet threat, the need for European and American leaders to present a common front is reduced, while the attractiveness of criticizing allies for domestic political benefit is increased. The ability of the United States to respond to populist and isolationist sentiment is enhanced, and in Europe, there is the scope for the redirection of political energy from the Atlantic Alliance to the unification project. If 11-9 made the world much safer for disagreement across the Atlantic, 9-11 created the grounds for real disagreement. One does not have to see the United States is coming from Mars and Europe is coming from Venus to recognize that 9-11 led Americans to a much greater reassessment of their feeling of vulnerability and insecurity than took place in Europe. This, in turn, led to a very substantial reorientation of U.S. foreign policy towards the objective of confronting terror and the states that sponsor and comfort terrorists. While French newspapers
did proclaim solidarity with America on September 12th. 9/11 has not had anything like the impact on the European approach to the world that it has had on the American view. With the Soviet threat removed and the focus shifted to out-of-area issues, it is in retrospect unsurprising that transatlantic tensions have increased. The nature of out-of-area preoccupations, their location in the Middle East, where there have long been profound disagreements between the United States and Europe, the fact that the U.S. was victim on its own soil for the first time in nearly two centuries, and the salience of issues of preemptive attack, where capacities are highly asymmetric, all contribute to the increase in tensions. Some look at all of this, the success of the alliance in achieving its original objectives, the very different orientations of the United States and Europe with respect to current challenges, and look towards an end or profound alteration in the alliance. From a European perspective, the idea is heard that standing up to or containing the United States ought to become a major objective of European foreign policy. On the American side, some wonder out loud whether European integration continues to be in America's interest, or whether it instead degrades the ability of the United States to assemble coalitions of the willing on an issue-by-issue basis. Less radical is the suggestion, sometimes made explicitly, but more often revealed implicitly, that an amiable divorce between the United States and Europe is desirable, inevitable, or both, given their divergent interests and philosophical approaches. These views seem to me, to the members of our task force, to be dangerously misguided. While no one can predict how the future will evolve, I am convinced that it is enormously in the interests of the United States, Europe, and the world that the transatlantic alliance continue to be a, if not the central element in the grand strategy of both the United States and the nations of Europe. This proposition is often defended with resort to cliches, the shared heritage of the West, the importance of a community of democracies, the traditions of close cooperation, and so forth. And indeed, propositions often become cliches because they are so obviously correct. But the necessity of the transatlantic alliance can be given a much more concrete defense. The central paradox confronting American statesmen is this: American influence, American power, is at its zenith, and American influence is at its nadir. U.S. military dominance has never been greater. After five decades of convergence between the economic strength of other industrial nations and the United States has pulled ahead over the last decade. The best available demographic and productivity forecasts suggest that this divergence is likely to persist. And yet events in Iraq, in North Korea, in the Middle East, the difficulty the United States had in generating support of even traditional American, Latin American allies for Security Council resolutions in support of the Iraq War suggest how little international influence we now have. No thoughtful American can be oblivious to the global backlash against the United States manifested in the public opinion polls I cited earlier, and in similar polls on other continents. Surely, if the United States is to succeed in achieving its primary objectives, whether these objectives be successful confrontation of terror or the more ultimate ones of spreading democracy and promoting international integration around the world, Americans must recognize that they cannot succeed alone. Without the leverage provided by the need for protection from the communist threat, America must find other means of influence. One nation may be able to win a war, but it usually takes many to win a peace. Legitimacy matters, and it depends on international support. And if international imperatives were not enough, there is this. As we are seeing today, the American political system is unlikely to provide enduring support for international ventures carried out alone and without foreign support. Without European support, it is not possible to imagine the United States assembling meaningful coalitions of other nations. The resources of Europe, the influence of Europe in international fora, and the common values shared by the United States and Europe all mean that if, as Americans like to believe, American influence is such as to make us an indispensable nation, then the nations of Europe are indispensable allies. What about European interests? I cannot presume to speak for Europe, but it would seem to me that its interests in the continuing strength of the transatlantic alliance is still very strong. The world remains a dangerous place, and the American capacity to project force is not likely to be matched in the next several decades, certainly without very substantial economic sacrifice. Closer to home, if the United States and Europe do not find an effective modus vivendi, there will inevitably be increasing tensions within Europe as different nations take different views on actions taken by the United States. The events of the last 18 months, I would suggest, have been not only unsettling across the Atlantic, but also across the English channels and across a variety of intra-European borders. Finally, the most visionary of European projects, the gradual extension of international law and institutions to the global community on the model of what has happened in Europe over the past half century, cannot be a viable concept without the successful cooperation of the United States. If these considerations for the United States and for Europe were not sufficient to make the case for the importance of the alliance, there's the issue of how the global system will evolve if the United States and Europe go in separate ways. There will not be successful cooperation on issues like global warming and weapons of mass destruction. And yet these are issues that cannot see progress without global cooperation. But there is a more ominous prospect. On current evidence, a quarter century from now, China and India will likely be great powers, and there will have been dramatic growth in the economic strength and political power of the other nations of Asia. If the United States and Europe seek to jockey for influence in this part of the world, as they surely will, without a firm alliance, then, as these nations seek to establish their place in the world, we will see a return, this time on a global basis to the kind of great power game international system that prevailed in Europe before the First World War. Peace did prevail for a long time in that system, but ultimately it was unsustainable. All of these considerations for the United States, for Europe, for the global system, point to a common conclusion. While the original objectives of the Atlantic Alliance, winning the Cold War and assuring peace within Western Europe, have been achieved and are now not in serious jeopardy, it is no less true today than it was a half century ago that the prospects for enduring security for the United States, Europe, and the world depend on the Atlantic Alliance. If this argument for the importance of the Atlantic Alliance is accepted, what is to be done? In important respects, the challenge is philosophical. The challenge is really in the attitudes political leaders take as they act. If there is a genuine commitment to consultation, to keeping the rhetorical temperature low, to cooperation, to managing disagreements, to seeking broad common purposes, the dangers I have highlighted will be avoided. Whatever precise arrangements are made for the form of summits or whatever particular initiatives are launched. And without a genuine commitment on the part of political leaders, no architecture of meetings and organizations or particular set of initiatives will make much difference. This is a moment when political leaders are truly challenged. For in democracies, leaders both shape and respond to public opinion. There is the danger of a mutually reinforcing negative dynamic as leaders respond to and in the process exacerbate current trends in public opinion. And there's a very real prospect of a positive dynamic as trust is restored across the Atlantic. An alliance only has meaning if countries do things because of the alliance that they would not otherwise have done out of their calculation of national self-interest. In recent years, the United States and Europe have increasingly had different primary areas of concern, with Americans identifying terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, and the export of democracy as of the greatest concern, and Europeans placing more weight on issues like global warming, economic development, and the strengthening of international institutions. There has been too little willingness on both sides to allow allies to pursue their priority concerns. The common agenda has too often been the intersection rather than the union of national priorities. I would submit that if the transatlantic relationship is to be strengthened over the next several years, Europeans will need to understand and find ways to accommodate the security preoccupations of the United States, and Americans will need to be more cooperative than in the recent past in addressing problems of global concern, even where they do not pose an imminent threat to our national security as conventionally defined. If this is to suggest a complementarity between American and European priorities, there is also complementarity between American and European capacities. As I already suggested, whatever happens in the evolution of European defense policy, the United States' capacity to project force will far exceed that of Europe for the capacity for the foreseeable future. Equally, barring a sea change in the preferences of the U.S. polity, Europe's ability to contribute to peacekeeping efforts and more generally to the global development effort will far exceed that of the United States. Complementary capacities as well as complementary priorities should provide a basis for cooperation. Let me conclude by identifying three specific areas where I believe substantially more intense dialogue and cooperation between the United States and Europe will have substantial benefits in the years ahead. First, the related issues raised by terrorism and rogue states. In both cases, there is strong reason to doubt the efficacy of conventional deterrence. Think of suicide bombers. And the question of preemptive action arises. Whatever one's view on the Iraq War, questions of preemption will loom larger in the future than they have historically. On the one hand, it is hard to imagine a stable world in which all nations claim the right to preempt based only on their own threat assessments. On the other, it is difficult to believe that major nations will or should completely cede to some international community process decisions that they regard as fundamental to their security. Without judging specific cases, there is clearly a need for some clarification of the rules of the road in this area. And if these rules, or at least movements towards a shared philosophy, do not come from transatlantic dialogue, it is hard to see where they will come from. Second, the future of the global trading system. Despite my background, I've said almost nothing about economics this afternoon, because I don't think that economic issues are fundamental in thinking about the transatlantic relationship at this point. Political differences so far have had only mild impact on business decisions on either side of the Atlantic, and my years in government make me doubt that businesses will be a strong source of political pressure on issues that are not primarily commercial. On the other hand, as I look at the global economy going forward, with all the uncertainties that lie ahead, one thing is clear. The prospects for sustained global expansion and all the benefits that it brings will be much greater if the project of increased international integration in trade and investment keeps moving forward. History also teaches that the chances of rising Asian powers being successfully accommodated by the international system depends on what happens to the trading system. And the history of every past trade round suggests that here too, successful cooperation between the United States and Europe is both necessary and fairly close to being sufficient for success. Third, the Middle East. Events in the Middle East over the next decade will be as or more consequential for both the United States and Europe than events in any other region. American and European approaches to the Middle East have in recent years not been well aligned, with real differences in views on Israeli-Palestinian issues, on how best to deal with Iran, and, of course, on Iraq. And yet, in each of these spheres, it is difficult to see how either the United States or Europe will achieve its objectives alone. Indeed, the traditional differences in view between the United States and Europe mean that any meaningfully common approaches that can be forged will have that much more legitimacy and impact. Without demonizing anyone in the Middle East, there is much to be gained from serious transatlantic cooperation in this crucial region. So it is perhaps appropriate that I say all of this in Britain. For as your Prime Minister powerfully explained earlier this week, Britain's destiny lies both with the United States and with Europe. And so, as much or more than any other nation, you have a great stake in the transatlantic alliance. So do we all. Let us join in the hope that in responding to a variety of very different threats and opportunities, it will make as great a contribution to the first half of the 21st century as it did to the last half of the 20th. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Larry, for that fascinating tour. And we now have some time for questions, and we have some microphones, and I see hands already, so I don't have to exert the chairman's traditional introducing of a question while you all think. So I'm going to go start from the balcony up at the top. Thanks. Yep. If you could say who you are, and that would be helpful.
My name is Benjamin Bilsken. I'm from the Netherlands. I have a question for President Summers. What do you make of the idea that was expressed by Thomas Friedman a few weeks ago in a column that since the threat to NATO has shifted south from the east, that Egypt, Israel, and Iraq at some point should join?
I guess my view is never say never. But I don't think of that as a plausible near-term evolution of NATO. There's a very profound difference between a security alliance and a international organization. And NATO has traditionally functioned as an international, as a security alliance to protect the common security interests of its neighbors. And it would be a very profound change for NATO to become a UN-like organization that had as its crucial objective preventing conflicts between its members. And so I would not think that the extension of NATO was the right way to do what is surely very important, which is to find common and constructive structures that can bring the parties in the Middle East together.
So we have that in the nice idea box, a bit like merging our endowments, but over there.
My question may be a bit awkward, but I'm sure you will address it in your customary diplomatic way. To what extent, my name is Jim Kennedy. I am no longer affiliated by virtue of being an octogenarian. To what extent might a change of the administration in Washington serve to facilitate the attainment of some of the wishes expressed in your very carefully thought out lecture.
There are people here from the Harvard Alumni Association who are thinking to themselves that about half of Harvard alumni are Democrats and about half of Harvard alumni are Republicans, and that this question probably has more potential to create unhappiness than it has to create happiness. Look. Look, I served in a Democratic administration, and I'm proud to have served in a Democratic administration, and I was supporting the other guy in the 2000 election. That said, I think that what I was trying to express in talking about the significance of 11/9 and then talking about the significance of 9/11, in talking about the long-run interests here, in talking about the very troubling aspects of the evolution of European public opinion, is that I think it is a serious mistake to believe that the challenges with respect to the alliance are not going to be very real and require very concentrated effort and courage, whoever is the President of the United States on January 20th, 2005. There is a very strong tendency to see questions in terms of personality. And surely there, as I tried to suggest, have been serious mistakes made on both sides. But the fact is that there was a common existential threat caused by the Soviet Union. And the removal of that threat creates a great deal of room for disagreement and tension that didn't exist before. And so one has to work harder to maintain comity than one did when that common threat was inducing comity. So there's plenty that can and will be discussed in the course of the U.S. election campaign, but it seems to me there are some broad historical forces operating here that leaders in all countries need to think about, regardless of what political party they're in.
It's up there, yeah.
Robert Wade. Larry, in the Clinton administrations, you were a champion of open capital markets worldwide. You were a champion of the idea that states should not have the right to put impediments on the inflow and outflow of financial capital. And you were in good company, the company of the IMF, the company of The Economist magazine. Well, in the last 12 months, both the IMF and The Economist have done have pulled back from that position, and they are now saying that that the benefits of free capital mobility are less than they thought in the past, and the costs are higher. Whereas 18 months ago, you rebuked some faculty of the Harvard Business School for leaving the impression with their students that Malaysia's capital controls, introduced at the time of the crisis, could have been a good thing for Malaysia. It was a strong rebuke. The people there remember it to this day. And what I wonder is if in the last 18 months, especially since the IMF and The Economist have pulled back, you have yourself reconsidered the desirability of allowing nation states to put impediments on the free movement of capital.
It's really great to be in an academic setting. It's really terrific. Let me make 3 points, if I could, Robert. First, I do not, as president of a university, rebuke faculty members. As
president of a university, I do, and I've tried very hard to participate in the scholarly debate that goes on within the university, and I did vigorously discuss the view, and it is my view that the Malaysian capital controls, which were imposed coincident with the imprisonment and physical violence to the vice president of Malaysia so as to stop the outflow of capital that would follow that action if nothing was done, when Minister Anwar was imprisoned on trumped-up charges of sodomy, were badly wrong and were misguided policies. Were misguided policies with impure roots. Prime Minister Mahathir's recent comments on the role of the Jewish people in controlling the world financial system seemed to me to rather speak in favor of the view that I took. So I don't back off of my view that in presenting the Malaysian capital controls, the political context is extraordinarily important. With respect to the flow of capital, the position I've always taken is that the flow of capital into an economy should and will be affected by proper prudential regulation, that the ability to take bank deposits, that the ability to sell various kinds of commercial paper needs to be put in a context that assures adequate prudence and involves proper financial supervision, and that in the context of proper bank supervision, a great deal will happen that will discourage short-term capital flows. And that's something that I have always and consistently supported. The diagnosis that you've entered into, and one that Joe Stiglitz and others have supported, that suggests that countries are innocent victims of large-scale capital inflows, seems to me to be a misreading of the facts. If you look at Mexico's issuance of tesabonos, if you look at the Thai offshore banking facility, if you look at the design of Brazilian financial instruments with an orientation to attracting hedge fund flows, if you look at the continued maintenance of fixed exchange rates, if you look at the quasi-guarantees in Indonesia, in almost every case that is cited as a country that was ruined by excessive capital inflows, if you look closely at the policies of that national government, it wasn't a failure to resist capital inflows that was the problem, but it was a decision to dine with the devil that led the country in question to end up on the menu. And it has seemed to me that it is much the better policy to start by resisting those policies that represent invitations and biases in favor of inappropriate short-term capital flows and to concentrate on prudential supervision. And I have not seen the case where those two things together are not sufficient. But that is a very far cry from suggesting that somehow whatever anybody does that causes capital to come is appropriate.
I still feel warm when people praise prudential banking regulation, but I expect I'll grow out of it. But Dan, here at the front. Thank you.
That's really an Indian summer speech, Mr. Lawrence. Of course, with an aroma of English weather, I mean, autumn or haze or whatever. It's good. Let us move from this empire to the community. Of course, that is what for the academicians are here, I think. How would you compare? I mean, Osama bin Laden in the Tora Bora cave and HIV virus in a CD4 cell. How would you prioritize? What would be the outcome, you think? Because both, see, you, the Americans think that Osama is the threat to the world, whereas we in the third world think that HIV is all, along with HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria. Of course, I have read your speeches in your website. So how would you prioritize? And ultimately, what do you think will be the outcome of if you deal with these threats? And regarding the endowments, I'm sure that you will share all your endowments with the UNICEF or UNDP as well. Thank you.
I think we'll stay off of endowment management policy a little longer. I'm not entirely sure I understood the question, but it seems to me that the answer really lies in my notion of complementary priorities. I don't think the world's going to get where it wants to go without a serious attack on terror and its roots. And I think even the crudest observation on the financial position and socioeconomic background of those who were on the plains of September 11th belies the idea that confronting global poverty, as important and valuable as it is, constitutes a sufficient defense against terror. At the same time, everything we know suggests that a world in which poor nations are prospering, in which inequality is being reduced, is likely to be a much safer world than a world in which those things are not happening. And so I don't see the need to make a choice between those two projects. And indeed, when I spoke about complementary priorities and complementary capacities, I was really seeking to emphasize that by working together, the prospects for both the United States and Europe in living in a world where both those priorities are addressed is going to be that much greater.
Question right at the back.
Thank you. Professor Somers, Bernard Casey from the London School of Economics. I wanted to take up your point about the way forward, and you talked about U.S. concerns, and you talked about European concerns, and you talked about the problem of the intersection versus the union. And you mentioned what was in the respective sets of concerns. One of the problems which I see, and it relates to the opinion polls you quoted, is that Europeans tend to see the United States as the cause or one of the causes of their concerns, global warming, the role of international institutions, possibly even the creation or of terror, possibly as a source of disruption of international trade. In other words, this relationship is not a symmetric relationship. It is not apparent or automatically apparent to Europeans that there is this intersection which we can embrace, because our perceptions of one of the sets of that intersection is very different from our perception of the other one, and I don't think that is viewed symmetrically the other way around. We, the Americans, do not see the Europeans as the cause of their concerns. Thank you.
Not sure. I think you know, I think there are a lot of different elements in Europe and a lot of different elements in the United States with a lot of different perceptions. I'm not sure that the record of European commerce with the Middle East would be a record that would entirely win admiration throughout the United States. I'm not sure that sins of private fortune stashed in secret bank accounts is not a problem in which there's some difference in degrees of responsibility between continents. So I think you perhaps draw the point a little more starkly than I would. I certainly believe and tried to make clear that the United States needs to take a more cooperative posture than it has historically towards issues relating to global warming, to AIDS, to the global development effort. And that's part of a stronger and more effective transatlantic alliance. I think one can simultaneously believe, and I guess I hold both these beliefs, that there was quite a bit that was quite problematic in the Kyoto Treaty as negotiated, and at the same time believe that forging an effective international regime with respect to global warming needs to be a major priority for cooperation in the years ahead. And it seems to me that type of posture, if taken by the United States, would have the collateral benefit of promoting comity.
Question in the back.
Anke Green from Germany. You said in your speech, and just now in the answers to one of the questions, that integration has raised the living standards in both rich and poor countries. So how do you evaluate the fact that according to most measures, inequality has actually increased over the past decades? And how do you see the role of Europe and the United States in reversing this trend?
Well, let me say a couple things. First, there are a lot of different ways of measuring inequality. Here's one. Let's look at the inequality of how long people live on planet Earth. Is it the case that some people are dying when they're 5 and some people are dying when they're 95? Or is there a growing equality in lifespans? You look by that measure, which is measuring something very fundamental, there is no question that equality on planet Earth has very substantially increased over the last 3 decades. Second, if you look at the available measures of inequality and you take account of both cross-country inequality and within-country inequality, you also find that according to the best estimates, what I regard as the best estimates done by Surjit Bala from India or Xavier Salamartin at Columbia University, that driven substantially by the growth in China and India, global inequality has come down. Third, if you look at the particular issues of trade policies, if you look at protection in most countries, what one finds is that it is benefiting an urban upper middle class at the expense of the rural poor. There's much that can be done to reduce inequality, whether it is land reform, whether it is increased education, as I've advocated in the past, particularly for girls. But I don't think that a reasonable reading of the record supports the view that reducing international integration does anything for equality. And as I look at the textile tariffs that we have in both the United States and in Europe, and think about the income of the workers whose jobs are being protected and the potential income of the export jobs that are being lost in the developing world, it doesn't seem like a pro-poor strategy to me. Finally, I would caution those with idealistic energy around resisting international integration to look at the available evidence on the preferences that are expressed by people in developing countries. The aversion to the WTO and the IMF that is not uncommon among highly educated youth in Europe and to a lesser extent in the United States is very clearly not shared in Africa or in India or in others of the poorest countries, where those institutions and the project of globalization are much more highly regarded. It seems to me that that is something that should give the opponents of globalization at least some pause.
I'm going to take, I think, just two more before we close. I have one down at the front, and I had one right up at the back who's been waiting patiently. So could I take this one first and then?
Hi, I'm Adam White, graduate student here. Returning to your description of the capabilities of America and Europe, is a strong alliance between those able to wage war and those able to keep peace not going to undermine the capacities and legitimacies of both or one or other group?
I apologize, I didn't understand the question.
Well, if there's a strong alliance between people willing to make war and people desiring to keep peace, is there not a fundamental contradiction between those aims?
I don't think so. You can walk and chew gum at the same time. Seriously, it seems to me that the vision of the kind of society that I want to create and that I would guess everyone here wants to create, though we would have, there might be differences as to the means, seems to me is a society in which, on the one hand, there will be very strong deterrence of those who wish to blow up buildings to achieve political objectives or wish to sabotage airplanes or who wish to get nuclear weapons to pursue political objectives. And at the same time, this is a society in which global society in which great efforts are being made to preserve the environment and to raise the living standards of everyone on Earth. And so I think of those two objectives as being very much complementary. And it seems to me that the real danger is the naive perspectives that sometimes one hears in the United States that all problems can be solved through force or coercion, and the naive perspectives that one sometimes encounters elsewhere that simply enough foreign aid and enough economic development will cause harmony to take hold. And it seems to me the lesson of history really runs to the need for both approaches, and so I don't see any contradiction at all.
Thanks. Final question in the middle.
Yes, I was just wondering how you expect the Europeans to sort of join with the Americans after so many lies, and lies. I mean, after all, you've got an administration who stole the election in Florida. You've got an administration that refuses to investigate 9/11, the connection of the Bush family with the Bin Ladens. You've got a war that was a war of aggression. Don't you think it's more a question that whereas Bush is out to bash, Mr. Summers is out to sweet talk? And that basically you're both out to really make sure America establishes its world hegemony and to prevent any economic rival arising, whether there's a Democratic or a Republican administration.
Sorry, I didn't think we had two Yale alumni in here, but we...
I think, sir, I'm going to have to respectfully... No, I'm not going to sidestep at all. I'm going to respectfully disagree with you completely. I think I respect your opinion. Look, I think that I'm not going to defend. It's not my job. I don't work in the administration. It's not my job, and it's not my view to defend as what, with hindsight, would have been done with respect to every choice that's been made. I don't, with respect to the time that I was in government, seek to argue that every judgment we made was the correct one. I do believe that the judgments we made were thoughtful given the information that we had in the time, but we certainly made mistakes, and certainly the last thing I would want to ever defend is the proposition that any government anywhere has acted without mistakes. But I will tell you that I think the attitude that is implicit in your question is a troubling one, and that I read the history of the last half century, and indeed the history of the last decade, as in a very, very different way than you do. I believe that there are millions of people in Europe who are alive today who would not be alive today without the decisions of American presidents to put American lives at risk. And the suggestion implicit in your question of complete callous American disregard for the rest of the world speaks to a history that's very different than the history that I think that I have lived I have lived through. That is not to say there weren't plenty of mistakes made, but I think that your reading of motives is not one that I would at all share.
Thank you very much, Larry. I think we ought to bring this to a close now, since Larry has other important meetings to go to. I want to thank you for coming, and I want to thank him for both a fascinating speech and also for dealing with a very broad range of questions in such an admirable way. I think I take away two things. One, that the Council of Foreign Relations paper, when it appears, is certainly going to be one to read, because it looks to me as though it is really addressing some of the most important issues that we face on both continents. And secondly, I took away a rather optimistic message. If the Eurobarometer surveys are now being read, at least in Harvard, if not yet within the Beltway, then this is, I think, an optimistic sign. I suspect next week during the state visit on the streets of London we may hear some less optimistic views expressed about the transatlantic relationship, but let us hope that that is, as we say in English, recule pour mieux sauter, and that the prognosis that you have tried to develop this afternoon is one around which a consensus on both sides of the Atlantic is gradually built. I think it's been a privilege to have President Summers here, and particularly to have him use this occasion for such a wide-ranging and thoughtful address on the most important topics that we face. We're very grateful to you for coming. Thank you very much.